You are listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio.
The idea of abolition existed a long time, since before the Founding Fathers penned the documents. Ever since they brought us to this continent, a long line of thinkers pondered it, white and black fought for it, watching bombs fly for the niggas picking cotton fields. And often still we sitting on trial, slave catchers giving badges, prisons built all the time. Envision if we prioritize strong ties in the neighborhood so that they're stabler to stop crime. That's the mission of abolition. It's been this for a minute, an assistance for independence. We've been to march fight in the alleys with our allies on the ballot, with the power of the people. We will finally see freedom for our kind.
Hey! This is Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations.
Hurry up! So, how you been this week, Brad?
Man, I've been busy as... What the... My bad, yo. They're still popping off Memorial Day fireworks outside the crib, like right outside the window and shit.
Because what way to better honor the troops than induce PTSD reactions by firing explosives into the sky?
Shit, I'm in the hood right now, so I'm hoping this all fireworks. But anyway, yeah. what are we talking about today? Let's tell the people what's going down.
Today, we're talking about the election of progressive prosecutor Larry Krasner. He was up for re-election 2 weeks ago, and is kind of the de facto like figurehead of the progressive prosecutor movement. And so he recently was featured in a documentary, a little docuseries by PBS.
Is that how you heard of him?
I was aware of his work like over the last couple of years, but I think he's gained increasing popularity, and like his work has drawn increasing awareness through this documentary that recently came out. Mm. And then, yeah, he just faced re-election 2 weeks ago. And so we're going to talk a little bit about progressive prosecutors, what D.A. Krasner has done up in Philly, some of the dynamics of his reelection campaign, and then look at the impacts that D.A.s have had on some rappers that we know and love.
We'll talk about the musical relationship that rappers have had with the D.A.'s office, and as well as go into some real-life examples of the adversarial nature between rappers and prosecutors. So I know about the work that you did with the district attorney in Athens back in December, but what's your usual interaction with district attorneys?
Well, we both, you and I, we got out and we canvassed for Deborah Gonzalez, the progressive district attorney in December 2020. We're going to talk a little bit about like what a DA does, why does it matter for criminal justice reform? Right now, as we work on the city budget, the DA's office has requested, I think, like $174,000 increase in the budget recommendations for all these new programs, all this new stuff. And it's inciting a lot of conversation among myself and my fellow leftist commissioners about, you know, we've been in this moment of like realizing that public safety starts outside of the carceral system. It starts before the police arrive. It starts before you get to the district attorney's office where they're slapping you with charges and whatnot. And so ultimately, as we'll sort of lay out in our definition of what a DA does in a moment, you know, these people are prosecutors. These people are tasked with like deciding if people go to jail and for how long and, you know, what their bail is and all this kind of stuff. And so there's been some hesitance to invest additional resources into an office that ultimately, as progressive as it wants to be, it's still about putting people in jail.
And law enforcement. Well, yeah, you know, yeah. Something that I noticed when looking up things with the music is like, as people see within hip hop, a lot of the regard that the DA has almost been identical to that the police have.
Exactly.
Within hip hop.
Yeah.
Like identical, you know what I mean? Almost
totally.
Like to the point where they're referencing the same sentence usually, you know?
Right. Parole officers, district attorneys, police, they're all sort of like a part of the system. And as laymen, as people, you know, listeners who may not be involved in the criminal justice system, if you don't have like a criminal background or have family members or friends that do, you may not like peg a DA or someone like that as like the villain in the story as clearly as the police, where we see these images of police like brutalizing people, etc. And I say it's a false equivalency to say, a DA is just as bad as the cops, because the cops are the ones that give them all these cases that they then have to prosecute in the first place.
Is it? But are they supposed, like, so they're like, they're not supposed to have that. Well, obviously, they're not supposed to have that relationship. They have to work together, but they're supposed to be like separate things, right? Separate entities, like the DA's office and the police department, right? Like, it's not supposed to be like Law and Order, where they're kind of like one big unit together.
Exactly. The police like bring somebody in on certain charges, and then they decide whether to pursue those charges or dismiss them, you know, potential sentences, negotiating plea bargains, all that kind of stuff. And so DAs have typically run on like tough on crime stance of like colluding with the police, where like round them all up and let's lock them all up for life and get them off the streets forever. And so both here and up in Philly there and across the country, there's this movement of people who are coming in to try to reform the system from the inside by, not pursuing low-level crimes, prosecuting them, more lenient sentences, more rehabilitative or restorative justice techniques to actually help people get reintegrated into society after they have committed a crime. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, to me, and this has been my struggle recently with deciding whether or not to like better fund the DA's office, is like that $174,000 could also go into programs that would prevent people from getting picked up by the cops in the first place.
Yeah.
Similar to the logic of defund, like the cops arrive when the crime has already happened. But like if there had been a program in place to help support the person that committed the crime, well, why do you need the cops for? I feel similarly about district attorneys. But it's a hard calculus, and we're going to get into this more throughout the episode. But let's go ahead and hit the jump, and we'll see you all in a second.
So a district attorney is the chief prosecutor representing the U.S. state and the local government area, typically a county. The prosecution is a legal party responsible for presenting the case against an individual suspected of breaking the law, initiating and directing further criminal investigations, guiding and recommending sentences for offenders, and are the only attorneys allowed to participate in the grand jury proceedings. The prosecutors decide what criminal charges to bring, and when and where a person will answer those charges. In carrying out their duties, prosecutors have authority to investigate persons, grant immunity to witnesses and accused criminals, and plea bargain with defendants.
So for example, when we think about like prosecutors decide what criminal charges to bring. A recent example here in Athens, there was a guy who got into a domestic dispute with his girlfriend, wouldn't let her leave the house or something like that. So the district attorney's office had to decide whether to charge him with kidnapping, which has a mandatory life sentence, or false imprisonment, which is like 10 to 15 years. So those are the kinds of decisions they're making about people that get picked up by the cops with regards to, you know, the charges. And then it follows the impact on their sentencing, whether the person who got in a fight with his girlfriend is going to jail for life or 10 to 15 years if convicted, you know, found guilty for the crime.
Well, here's a question. This might not be something that you know, but is there like any sort of like a checker of the DA? Like, is there anyone that checks why they present certain charges to cases? I mean, obviously, you can't do everything in real time on the day that every case is filed. Is there any sort of process that goes back and looks after that sort of thing? Do you know?
I would say there's probably not a formal like role within the office or within the criminal justice system more broadly that is like checking the DA. I mean, I guess
it would just be something after the fact, like after scandal or something, then you would check it.
Sure. And so what RDA has been doing, and I believe something that Larry Krasner has done extensively in his tenure in office, is case review. So looking back at the sentencing that happened before they came in and determining, fairness, like is there any discrepancies based on race across like the data on who has been sentenced and for how long? Was there any sort of misconduct in the way the trial was undertaken? And a lot of times, I mean, we haven't had a case here yet, but often in other municipalities, we find that people get exonerated. It turns out that like, actually this is fucked up that they were sent to jail for this and for this long, and they actually ended up getting out. So district attorneys can check the work of previous, of their predecessors.
Yeah.
But in terms of an existing check on that office, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure if there exists outside of, like, public accountability. And then, like, public defenders, you know, who work to defend the folks that are brought before the prosecution, perhaps having some role in like, taking a look at how they're deciding criminal charges and sentencing and trying to weigh in against that if it's unfair.
Yeah.
But, yeah, across the country, there's been a lot of reform-minded prosecutors setting a new precedent of winning elections on platforms committed to both public safety and reducing mass incarceration. Folks within this quote-unquote progressive prosecutor movement have pursued a range of policies, including using diversion and treatment programs as alternatives to for people convicted for drug-related crimes, refusing to prosecute cases brought by officers with a history of dishonesty or unreliability, and then reducing prosecutions for lower-level crimes. So this is like a wave that's been sweeping the country in recent years, with the probably the most prominent figure in this movement being Larry Krasner, who was elected to as Philadelphia's district attorney in 2017.
Prior to seeking the district attorney seat, he worked as a criminal defense lawyer in Philadelphia for about 30 years, specializing in civil rights, frequently representing protesters. That's Black Lives Matter or Occupy Philadelphia protesters. He would do it pro bono, so that earned him that anti-establishment cred when he was a candidate in 2017. Mr. Krasner announced his first run after Donald J. Trump's presidential inauguration and his promise to stop prosecuting drug possession and prostitution and to hold police accountable for misconduct attracted a coalition of young progressives, labor unions, and moderate black voters behind him that boosted him to victory.
He had the track record to back it up, you know, when he was talking about holding police accountable. He had sued the police for civil rights violations 75 times prior to his run for office. So he had the bona fides, I guess, to bring out young progressives, bring out black folks, bring out people in the labor movement to support him, because, like, he had previously walked the talk.
Yeah, he showed them that he had the experience to, like, actually get the shit done.
Yeah. And then, yeah, indeed, during his first term in office, he ended criminal charges against those caught with pot, ended cash bail for minor misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies, pursued reduced supervision for parolees, and sought more lenient sentences for certain crimes, and even, when given the opportunity, declined to pursue the death penalty in capital cases. And as a result of all these efforts, the Philly DA's offices lowered the number of people in the city's jail by more than 30% and cut the city's probation rules by a third.
This work has earned Krasner the support of Philadelphia-based and raised rapper Meek Mill, who we've talked about on the show before, and who's had a couple of brush-ins with Krasner's office. Following Meek's own charges, incarceration, and probation throughout the early 2000s and 2010s, Meek co-founded the Reform Alliance, a project dedicated to getting 1 million people off probation, and has since been very outspoken about probation reform, having experienced it firsthand the way the terms of probation hindered his own rehabilitation. In addition to tweets in support of Krasner's re-election, Meek had also denied the purported link between Krasner's policies and the spike in gun crime in Philadelphia. He said, "Larry Krasner did not put 3,000 ghost guns in Phillies and is not to blame for the rising murder rate. We don't do 3D printing in the hood, so something happened," Meek tweeted back in April.
A good point. I mean, it's like, what do you think? You got to address where the guns are coming from. They're not coming from the DA's office. But we'll get more into that in a second. Krasner's work has also been praised by the ACLU, particularly the work of his sentencing integrity unit, which has exonerated 20 innocent people who combined lost hundreds of years of their lives in prison during his 3+ years as DA. As well, the ACLU has opined none of his predecessors has been as committed to rooting out violent cops as Krasner. See, for example, the Philly DA's office taking a case to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, challenging the Commonwealth's use of force law in a case stemming from the prosecution of Officer Ryan Pownell, who shot and killed David Jones as he fled from the officer. So he's cracking down on violent cops, exonerating innocent people, letting people out of jail that are in there for low-level crimes, or lessening the burden of probation on folks that are, you know, doing quote unquote community supervision. Sounds great, right? Well,
we're still in the pandemic. So, you know, during his tenure and the last year, especially, homicide and gun violence in Philadelphia are on rising levels not seen since the 90s. The skyrocketing homicide rate resulting from the pandemic has now created public cries for making more arrests and getting killers off the streets.
So we're talking about people are saying, oh, this guy is leaning on crime. He's letting people out of jail. He's not prosecuting people. And that's why gun violence is spiking in the city. So the police seized upon this pandemic-driven rise in crime to promote Mr. Krasner's opponent, Carlos Vega, an assistant DA who Krasner, or a former assistant DA who Krasner fired upon taking office in 2018. However, criminologists have said it would be impossible to substantiate the claim that Krasner's policies had led to more gun crime, as gun violence has risen sharply in many cities last year, regardless of whether their prosecutors were considered progressive. So,
I mean, I don't understand how people are like pointing at like anything that was happening post-pandemic to like as an explanation for the rise in crime. Like, the pandemic hit, the economy took a hit, and there's mad guns in the country. So like, what do people expect is gonna happen? That's not like the result of a progressive district attorney, obviously.
Right.
It's just like a stupid explanation.
And my view is that for every person we incarcerate, we create another criminal. For every father we take out of a home and put behind bars, that's another child that's gonna become destabilized because they lost a breadwinner, because they lost a mentor. And now that kid's gonna go out and start robbing people and shooting people, or like looking for supports outside the home because he no longer has one of his parents. Mm-hmm. And it's gonna start rolling with the gang or rolling with folks, you know, let's go around breaking into houses. Oh, let's go shoplifting. You know, every time a mother loses a son to the carceral system, you know, That drives alcoholism, that drives drug addiction, that drives hopelessness and despair, that then forces people to turn to more crime. So, you know, on the one hand, when you have people saying, oh, you're letting people back on the streets where they're reoffending, at the same time, I think that every time we put someone away, we're further destabilizing a community by taking away a family member or a friend or a breadwinner or a colleague, employee, you know, whatever, that ultimately drives crime further.
Exactly.
But yeah, so the Fraternal Order of Police, the union that represents 14,000 current and retired officers in the city of Philadelphia, has thrown everything they have at DA Krasner in an attempt to oust him, and even went so far as to park a soft serve ice cream truck outside the district attorney's office to emphasize that Mr. Krasner had been soft on crime, which I love Larry's response. In response, Mr. Krasner's campaign released a statement of support from Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's.
The union's given hundreds of thousands of dollars to Krasner's opponent and has encouraged Republican voters to register as Democrat in order to vote Krasner out of the Democratic primary.
Yeah, so Vega was running against Krasner in a Democratic primary. It's like, I think Democrats outnumber Republicans in the city of Philadelphia like 7-1. So whoever wins the primary
it's gonna be
the DA. Yeah.
So Krasner has attracted criticism from the left too. He's basically been called by the ACLU for backing away from his promise to eliminate cash bail and stop holding juveniles in adult jails. His prosecutors routinely seek to detain people and have been asking judges to issue bail orders of $1 million against certain defendants. Once a huge proponent of ending cash bail for many offenses, during his first term, he actually criticized judges for settling bail too low for gun crimes. On the juvenile justice front, virtually the same number of youth are being charged as adults as before Krasner became district attorney, due in large part to Pennsylvania's direct file law, which requires that young people accused of certain crimes start in adult court.
So an additional critique was leveraged by Ernest Owens, who wrote in Philly Mag, as a black queer progressive who was called for the defunding of the police, I find Krasner's performative wokeness a pattern of behavior in which he spends more time acting self-righteous on social justice issues than achieving progressive goals, distracts from the causes I believe in. For starters, the concept of being a progressive prosecutor is oxymoronic. Mm. Prosecutors, just like the police, are part of a flawed system that incarcerates people. Prosecutors are committed to convicting people. That's the job. Whether a DA's office decides to offer lesser charges or not, the idea that it can serve as a progressive institution is patently false. I would never consider a police commissioner progressive. Regardless of how many reforms commissioners may plan to make, they're still operating within an oppressive system. What makes the DA's office any different, given the institution's longstanding history of criminal injustice to poor Black and brown people? This next part kind of gets at what they reveal a lot through the documentaries, through the docuseries, which I actually did watch some of recently. Ernest continued, as much as Krasner would like to pretend the calls for more law and order are only coming from Trump or the Fraternal Order of Police, they're also coming from the Black and brown communities he claims to be listening to. In the PBS documentary, following Krasner's first term, a Black mother expresses rightful rage at Krasner after his office frees the man who killed her teenage son because investigators accessed incriminating evidence without a warrant. So, and then there's another example from the documentary where the certain members of the family of a slain police officer wanted Krasner to pursue the death penalty for his murderer. And he had, you know, run on a pledge of not pursuing the death penalty. And so ultimately he kind of went against not what some of the victim's family wanted.
Yeah.
And these are Black and brown and low income people that live in Philadelphia.
It's one of those things that it's like, you know, people aren't a monolith. Like, not everybody, you know, not everybody is as tied to ideology as like has like a sometimes get when we're in our bubbles of like dealing with other people who are as political as we are all the time. You know what I mean? You forget that like some people.
Yeah, I mean, and like I think we all struggle with a desire for vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have very deeply socialized into us conceptions of what justice is. And it often means making the person that hurt you suffer. And so I don't think we can even blame people for like turning to that in their most, in their darkest moments when they've lost a member of their family. Because that's what we're taught all our lives, that justice is. And so grappling with that, like, what does it mean for us to listen to those voices, to center those voices in the work that we do, even if we disagree with this orientation towards punishment and revenge as means of justice? It's something that he has to grapple with. We all have to grapple with in this work of criminal justice reform.
I mean, it's definitely a tough job. I can definitely see how it could be conflicting for somebody who is, you know, stepping into like that role, and maybe they have you know, a view and a philosophy that's one way, but just like being part of that machine requires you to have to make decisions that, you know what I mean, just fundamentally are going to make you be opposed to what you otherwise would be cool with, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I always like, I don't know if I ever asked you this when we were canvassing for Bernie and stuff like that, but like, did you ever, like, did anybody who's like a Bernie supporter ever like wonder if like whatever issue you want to think about it, that Bernie or position that like someone like Bernie Sanders has now, and then they get in, and then he gets into office and like he hears something that none of us have privy, you know, information to, where he's like, oh, okay, well then that shit that I was saying when I was, I can't do that, obviously. You know what I mean? Like, because of the job just makes you fundamentally, from the very nature of it, in order to do it a certain way, you know what I mean, you either have to throw out how it's done, or you have to like kind of like go against some things that you might believe in.
I face that in politics constantly, where it's like balancing my own values against my duty to be responsive to the folks that elected me, and like living in a representative democracy, being the people's voice, being versus I guess like embrace of the position that people trusted me to make the right decision based on my consciousness when they voted for me.
Yeah.
So maybe I am just allowed to do what I want to do. Like, there are often very conflicting views on a number of policy things we have to vote on. It's also like, which voices do you listen to? Like, people want to paint like Black and brown communities as a monolith. Like, oh, like all the time I hear Black people like, oh, Black people don't want to defund the police. And then on the other side, like the young Black people are like, oh, all my niggas like be screaming fuck 12. All my niggas be screaming fuck 12. What? And each side wants to claim that they are the voice of their demographic.
Community, yeah.
Of their community. Like, I really represent the community. What I say, really, yeah, don't listen to these niggas over here. So, no, it's really tricky. It's really tricky.
Yeah, no, it's conflicting. I mean, you know, that's... things like that are... those are the things that make me... you know, very, very respectful of people, anybody. There's a certain base level of respect that I have for anyone who approaches getting into politics in good faith to begin with, because it's like, man, there's some hard decisions that you got to make, you know?
Yeah, straight up.
So in the end, Larry Krasner ended up dusting Carlos Vega.
Ayo!
Krasner earned more than double Vega's vote total. Krasner's victory 2 weeks ago likely assures his re-election ahead of November's general election. Because the registered Democrats there outnumber the Republicans like 7-1 up there. So he's a safe bet to win the whole thing.
What's interesting is that Krasner's mandate is now far greater than it was after his initial election in 2017, when he won the Democratic primary with 38% of the vote in a multi-candidate field. This year, in a one-on-one race, he got about 65% of the vote. So more people voted for him this time than last time, despite the spike in crime, despite some of the critiques on the left. And so it's interesting that, yeah, here we are. I mean, I think there's a number of aspects of the zeitgeist that made this manifest. Like,
well, I'm assuming...
the fucking biggest social movement of my goddamn lifetime last year, or that we're still in, you know.
I'm assuming that the Carlos Vega guy, he was the Republican candidate?
Well, he was running in the Democratic primary.
But he was a Republican candidate, though? Or was he running in the Democratic?
He was running as a Democrat. Yeah. Okay. Backed by the cop union.
Yeah.
With, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah. And so, what some have had to say about why this happened, Nicholas O'Rourke, the organizing director for the Pennsylvania Working Families Party, who supported Krasner, told The Nation, "Voters rejected the FOP's fear-based propaganda and sent a clear message. We cannot incarcerate our way to public safety." So, I mean, this general idea, this reimagining of what it means to make our community safe, I think expanded his support as the consciousness has been raised around the need for us to just do things utterly differently, more so than it was in 2017 when he was first elected.
Kendra Brooks, the Philly councilwoman, also elected with the WFP party line in 2019, had this to say. "The uprising clearly articulated that the power of the people was greater than any one election or elected official. That if real change was going to happen, we would have to fight for liberation in every avenue of power."
And so I think this is, again, one of the results of the uprising. People's increased awareness and attention paid to local politics. That things like defund, that things like ending mass incarceration start with your DA. They start with your police department. It starts with your public defender's office. It starts with your local county jail. It's not, you know, going to Biden and, like, expecting him to fucking do anything about it, because he architected the fucking system we're living in. And the federal level doesn't have a ton to do with what's happening in your neighborhood with regards to the people getting picked up by the cops and sentenced to decades in prison for stupid shit. All of that is controlled, you know, locally. And I think maybe out of last summer's uprising came an increased awareness of that, increased engagement with that. And that using every avenue of power to dismantle the system of mass incarceration, even one that is inherently complicit in it to a degree. So,
yeah, I mean, like they said, you know, progressive prosecutor definitely has oxymoronic sort of vibe to it. But, you know, you got to work with what you got. And sometimes you can't be so idealistic in terms of, like, oh, everything kind of has to be, you know, the perfect way that you would want it to be. You kind of have to just, you know, go with what you got. And what we got right now is the system. So, you know, you can't bring it down if you're completely incapable of infiltrating it. So you have to try that first. So let's get into the music portion of things, where we... we're going to be discussing the relationship between hip-hoppers and the district attorney's office. We're going to get to that after the jump. Good afternoon.
yeah, cause fuck what she said. She don't give a fuck about your ass anyway. Up northbound.
That was a line from the late Notorious B.I.G. on the song Realest Nigga featuring 50 Cent. I think I was like a 2002 mixtape joint. But anyway,
yeah,
the district attorney as the character, if you will, in hip hop has been regarded like the police, like we were talking about in the at the beginning of the episode. It's mostly like an adversarial relationship. Most of the references of it are in resentment or with ill will, people expressing like, hey, fuck the DA. There's the famous outro ad-libs at the end of Tupac's Pitchin' Me Rollin' where he's literally just addressing the DA. He's like, hey, DA, can you see me? I'm rolling, bitch. Pitchin' Me Rollin', you know, that sort of shit. Meek Mill was in a courtroom in his hometown, Philadelphia, back in 2012. Based on reports, the judge presiding over the case had scolded him for his song titled The Ride. We're going to check that out right now.
Dead lies, the DA said she hate me, but I don't understand. When I just rock the show in front of 50,000 fans, I think that bitch racist. She probably in a clan. She take up.
Damn. That's so, I mean, it goes so deep. It's like she taking her frustrations out on people in her courtroom. Probably need a man. I mean, that's like a harsh critique, but that
so,
is.
The judge admonished him for the line.
Calling her a bitch, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and instructed him not to mention the DA in any of his future recordings. We've also discussed the nationwide phenomena of local DAs using rap lyrics as evidence in cases against local rappers in their areas. With the example that we had of Draco the Ruler, sometimes back we had that example. But just in searching, there's almost too many cases for us to even really reference because it seems like there's one going on in every state. I highly recommend this article. It's an NPR article called Rap Lyrics in Court, Art versus Evidence. But it's pretty much a breakdown of, like, it's kind of like a debate article between like a criminal justice advocate and then like some legal minds, and they're pretty much going back and forth about why so many district attorneys' offices are using rap lyrics and stuff like that and on what basis they're using the lyrics to do that. What are your thoughts on that whole thing?
Well, I actually participated in a panel with this woman named Andrea Dennis earlier this year, where we were talking about the idea using rap lyrics in trial. It's interesting because myself and my friend Montu, who were on the panel, were talking about how rap is the CNN of the streets. You know, rap is this journalistic, you know, expression of our lived experiences, our true reality. And then the author was actually like, "Actually, you all are wrong. Rap lyrics are fictional. Rap lyrics are impressionistic. They are not talking about actual things that happen most of the time. They're talking about things that they would like to have happen or things they want to boast having happened, even though they did not. It has like a flex that is not actually grounded in reality. And for that purpose, and then for those reasons, rap lyrics should not be used on trial." And I actually, it like fucked with me because I was like, damn.
My
argument for why, like, rap is journalism, rap is this and that, also can be used against us of like, rap is journalism. Well, this nigga said he shot 4 people in his song.
I mean, so. I think it's like a case by case basis. You know what I mean? Like, I just can't comfortably be like, I generally think it's out of bounds things because I can think of specific examples just imagining it in my head where it's like, I would understand that. Like, for example, if like Eminem's wife were to go missing and the cops are like, yo, we want to talk to Eminem because we heard some shit. Like, I'm not, all I'm saying is, I'm just saying I would understand why a detective would be like, I'm going to look into that. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like if you can go on somebody's Instagram account and like, this person was posting that they did this and they're posting that they did that, and we connected A plus B, and that person got caught because they snitched on themselves on Instagram. And it seems like people would probably do that in rap songs. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
And if there is, I know that there was that case of what was his name? Is why.
YMW Melly,
yeah. Like, again, you know, I don't know the full details of it, so I you know, hesitate to speak on it like that. But like, from my general understanding of how that case was going down, he had a song called "Murder on My Mind" that was like a huge hit, and it's like literally like giving evidence. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a stretch. Like, oh, we're just gonna grab. You're just gonna like take all of his songs. It was like, no, it was like, oh no, when he said this, it meant, you know what I mean, in that particular song. And like something like that, it's like with me, I'm like, oh well, I don't want to see somebody go to jail, but at the same time, like literally talking about somebody that was killed, and that person needs justice and accountability too.
So it's complicated. And DAs do that. DAs can bring in lyrics as evidence. Happened with Drakeo the Ruler, happened with Melly. Happens all the time. And then there are legal minds on either side of the issue trying to determine the legitimacy of the practice.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd have to start seeing it happen. I don't know. It's one of those things where, I don't know. It's a very, very, for me, conflicting issue. Because, like, on the one hand, I definitely can imagine like a totalitarian state where motherfuckers are just pulling up people's writing and their artistic expressions and manipulating it and using it to lock people up and shit like that. But I'm not necessarily sure that that's what's happening on that front, though.
Yeah. But, I mean, we had that whole episode about Pablo Hasél, who had lyrics about praising terrorists and insulting, you know, insulting the monarchy. So I guess it just like becomes a slippery slope thing as well of like, at what point is like free speech not, can you not just say, like, shout out, nigga. Like, just because you want to say it in a song.
Exactly.
And now you're being criminalized for it.
In the way things are headed now, I can totally see if they can start convicting people on stuff like this, then if you make a song that's like a protest song or like something that's got like a Run the Jewels, Eat the Rich and Burn Down a Bank sort of vibe to it. Oh, you inspired them to burn down the fucking yada yada banker to break such and such window. Now you gotta, you know, you incited a riot with your song. I can see that.
Probably what Keisha Lance Bottoms called up Killer Mike and said when she got him to that press conference last summer where they were like burning down the CNN center. Like, well, Mike, I actually have the DA on line two, and we're very concerned about your lyrics about give them CEOs hell, the burning of the sofa, goddamn, I love the smell. Well, when we find them, we don't kill them, we just waterboard them.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to need you to come down here for this press conference. Otherwise, look outside your window. APD is sitting and waiting to bring you to the Fulton County Jail.
I don't even want to put that bad juju in the air because I definitely got some stuff out there that could definitely be twisted. On the next subject. I wanted to talk about this last thing. Is this a situation with Mark Jones, who was a district attorney hopeful a year ago. He was running in Columbus, Georgia for a district attorney of how do you pronounce that?
Chattahoochee.
The Chattahoochee. That's quite... quite a word. The Chattahoochee Judicial Circuit. Now, he filmed a video. It was a Get Out the Vote video with a rapper called Georgia Boy. We're going to listen to a little bit of that right now.
Get out of vote. Get out of vote. Do it.
Yeah.
Freedom and legalize weed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The people, the egg who we need.
Why don't? Right now. Get out of vote.
No capping. He on the ballot. He gonna be preaching and talking about it. He about to ask.
Who? What? Jones.
Oh my God. All right. That's enough of that. Right. What the fuck did I just watch?
So, yeah.
So, in the video, I'll explain. So, in the video, it's like a bunch of people hanging out, cars parked around them, very like hip hop video style. Georgia Boy.
Slow motion.
Georgia Boy's rapping. People got like Mark Jones signs. But then Mark Jones is this skinny ass white boy in like a blue suit with a red tie, and he's like bouncing, giving the thumbs up. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
An arrest warrant was issued shortly after, just 13 days ahead of his Democratic primary, by the Columbus police, and they charged him with four felonies and two misdemeanors. connection with the video that was posted to Facebook. After the police said his campaign had failed to get a permit for the shoot in the parking lot of the Columbus Civic Center. Now, the charges included, check this out. The charges included conspiracy to commit criminal damage of property, conspiracy to commit interference with government property, and conspiracy to commit reckless conduct. And they were filed after Jones gave a stinging criticism of the District Attorney's Office of Columbus and the Columbus Police in response to the reports that officers were confiscating marijuana and consuming it while on the job.
But he won the election and is currently the district attorney.
He ended up turning himself in, but he's currently the district attorney elect. So I assume everything worked out. I didn't follow much on the case.
Yo, but that's crazy, right? I gotta give the man props for that shit. Yeah, that's wild. That's crazy.
I'm gonna try to reach out to him so we can get him on the show to talk to him because, you know, he's billed himself, at least I could tell from his Facebook page, he's billed himself as the people's DA, you know what I mean? And he's hip-hopping around, so I kind of want to talk to the dude and see what that's all about, you know what I mean? So we might have to follow this up on this episode. Well, I mean, that's what we got for today, and we will be back next week as we always are. I think we are going to be, if the things align the way they're supposed to, I think we're going to be talking about battle rap in the next episode and some of the political and social implications that has just in the culture of hip hop and just in pop culture in general. That's going to be a fun one. Can't wait to do that. You got anything going?
What I got? Nah, I'll see y'all next week. I ain't got shit. I ain't got shit for y'all.
All right. Well, everybody be safe out there. You know, we can't go anywhere without spitting some funky, fresh raps. Ayo, Joel, can we please get a beat? Hey, this is Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are Waiting on Reparations.
See you next week.
Listen to Waiting on Reparations on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.